From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. Today, Senator Gary Peters tells us about an investigation into slowdowns at the post office.
It's broader than just ballots. It's about, as I mentioned, it's about medicines. It's about paychecks. It's about Social Security checks.
And the fall school semester is just around the corner. We'll check in on Michigan's homeless students.
What I think not many people know about is the fact that one out of every 12 students among Michigan's fifth graders experienced homelessness at some point during elementary school.
And writer Donovan Hahn on very modern metaphysical collisions.
When we have more information, more ways of understanding the world than we'll ever be able to explore in a lifetime, that coincides with a kind of distance from an actual firsthand knowledge of the natural world.
Those stories and more coming up on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, filling in for April Baer. Later on the program, we'll check in with a University of Michigan researcher about the impact of the pandemic on Michigan's many homeless students.
What I think not many people know about is the fact that one out of every 12 students among Michigan's fifth graders experienced homelessness at some point during elementary school.
That's coming up in a bit. But first, during the pandemic, you've undoubtedly ordered more packages to be delivered to your house. And maybe you've noticed along the way that packages and parcels just don't make it to your house quite as quickly as you'd expect. Issues with the United States Postal Service have caught the attention of Senator Gary Peters, and he joins us here today. Senator Peters, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, great to be with you, Laura.
You've opened up an investigation into slowdowns with USPS. What prompted the investigation?
Well, what has prompted the investigation is what I've been hearing from folks all across the state of Michigan that are complaining that mail is not getting to them in the way that it used to. And they've seen this fairly recently in particular, that medicines that they would order and expect to get within 3 days are now taking, for example, up to 12 days in order to get those medicines. Social Security checks are delayed, bill payments. I mean, this is simply unacceptable. And folks are wondering what's going on in the Postal Service. What I've been hearing from the men and women who work at the Postal Service, our letter carriers and postal workers, I heard that there's a number of new policies have been put in place by the new Postmaster General, who was appointed to that position by President Donald Trump. And since he has come on board in the last couple months, new policies have been put in place. And according to the folks on the ground who are working in our postal offices, they're saying these new policies are slowing mail down. And they're very concerned. They're used to getting the mail out as quickly as it possibly can come in. And these new policies are actually slowing mail down. And that's unacceptable. We need to get to the bottom of it. And as a ranking member of Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee, we're the top oversight committee in the U.S. Senate, and I oversee the Postal Service, I'm asking a number of questions of the new Postmaster General because we need answers. We need to make sure mail is being delivered on time.
So is this an official investigation within the committee?
It is. It's a committee investigation. My committee staff is reaching out to folks, not just across Michigan, but also across the country. But and that's why we're asking folks who have stories, and I'm hearing stories from across the state, that they should let me know and go to my website, which is peters.senate.gov/postal. And tell me their story. What are they experiencing? What are their experiences in getting some of these critical medicines and just general mail? I want to find out, is it localized? Is it just certain parts of the state? Or is it all across the state where folks have concern? I know I'm talking to my colleagues in the U.S. Senate, and senators from across the country are saying that they're hearing the same thing in their individual states.
Ron Johnson, the senator from Wisconsin, is the Republican chairman of the committee. What are the conversations you're having with him about this? Is he on board with looking into this issue?
I have. I've talked to Chairman Johnson told him we need to have a hearing. He is hearing some of the very similar complaints in Wisconsin as well. He has assured me that we will have a hearing, and hopefully we will have that soon. But in the meantime, we need to collect this information. We need to be asking tough questions and getting more information, quite frankly, from the Postmaster General. I have sent letters, oversight letters to him. His response has been slow. In fact, initially his response was that these were not new policies being put forward across the country. They were individualized. And then in a second letter that I received from him, he said, well, no, these are national policies that we are putting in place. So the inconsistency is troublesome. And then he has failed to answer other questions, including what data went into the formulation of these new policies. Why were these new policies put in place? What was the objective data? What was the rationale for it? We have no explanation. And then if these policies are not working, which they appear not to be, what plans are going to be put in place to return to the service standards that we had prior to these policies?
And this was from the Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy?
That's correct.
So has he not then answered to why he thinks that this restructuring was necessary within the United States Postal Service?
Well, he believes that it'll be more efficient, and he's going to deal with some of the challenges in the Postal Service with efficiency. Our counter is that part of efficiency is getting mail delivered on time to people. Folks have choices when it comes to delivery and how they send packages. The U.S. Postal Service needs to have top flight service in order to continue to do the work that they do each and every day. So it's raised a lot of issues, lots of concerns, not only from my colleagues in the Senate, but everyday folks who rely on the Postal Service.
The timing of this, I think, needs to be noted. This alongside many complaints from the president, not only about the inefficiencies of the Postal Service, but also at the same time making many arguments about the possibility of fraudulent voting by absentee ballot or mail-in ballot and his strong concern that it will skew the election results in November. Are these things tied in your mind?
No, they're not tied at all. I mean, there's absolutely no evidence of fraud involved in vote by mail. You know, in Michigan, we've had vote by mail for senior citizens and folks who vote absentee if they're out of town. There has not been any evidence that there is fraud. It's safe and secure. In fact, it's curious because President Trump on many, many occasions has voted by mail himself. So apparently it's okay for him. He's just concerned about other folks, but there's no evidence. This investigation is about making sure that mail gets delivered as quickly as possible when folks can receive a ballot quickly after requesting it and then getting it returned to the clerk. But certainly it's broader than just ballots. It's about, as I mentioned, it's about medicines. It's about paychecks. It's about Social Security checks. We certainly expect the Postal Service to have quick delivery. And the service standards that they have been able to deliver over 200 plus years of their existence.
Because we are talking about a huge reliance on timing when it comes to the November election and mail-in ballots, is it reasonable to assume that any changes could be made to speed up the service or ensure that it will at least run to some degree reliably ahead of the November election?
Well, I think there is. And that's why we have to make sure we're investigating this and understand exactly what policies have been put in place to slow down mail delivery. Certainly what I've heard is that the overtime, for example, has been severely limited, that folks can't work overtime. I've heard that the trucks that deliver mail between postal offices are not allowed to make a second run, even though there's a pileup in mail. So those things can be fixed quickly. And certainly if you see a huge surge of mail coming forward, which we will likely see in November with the no reason absentee voting here in Michigan, certainly folks are going to need overtime. If you have a lot more mail coming in and your goal is to get it out as quickly as possible, you will need the personnel to make that happen. These changes can be made. And we can go back to the kinds of service standards we've seen in the past.
So why not privatize the United States Postal Service? What would be the argument that you would make that would just be an unreasonable ask?
Well, a couple of things. One, we know that the Postal Service is the only mail service that actually delivers to every single address in America. If you live in a suburban area or a city area, you may continue to get service. But if you're a far-flung rural area, it may be very difficult to get service, and it would likely be at a much higher cost in order to get that service. The Postal Service is based on the premise that everybody, no matter who you are or where you live, have access to postal services. It's critical for all the reasons that I've mentioned, including small businesses that are now going online and selling more of their products across the country. They rely on the Postal Service to make that happen. So it is a critical component of this country is to have that service. It's a service. It's not a, you know, as it's often been said, it's not a business. It's a service that everybody has access to and at an affordable price.
Senator Peters, before we let you go, I'd like to ask you a bit about the executive order signed by the president to continue or extend unemployment aid, as well as implement a payroll tax cut. There's a lot of concern on both sides of the aisle that the move sidesteps the role of Congress and may, in fact, be unconstitutional. But the president argues that he's stepping in where Congress wouldn't. So what would you have to say to that, since there has been such a stalemate over figuring out what the way forward is for unemployment benefits?
Well, we have to move forward, and everybody needs to be at the table. This is something that can be resolved. And, you know, it's interesting if you think of the main folks involved in the negotiation. We had Speaker Pelosi, Leader Schumer. We had representatives from the White House. But Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Republican Senate, was not even in those meetings. And he wasn't in those meetings because his caucus is split. Many members of his caucus simply do not support the Republican proposal. And it's curious, with an issue as big as this one, which is to deal with the COVID crisis and to make sure that we have the ability to deal with the health aspects along with the economic impacts of COVID. The fact that the president was out playing golf instead of being involved in the discussions, that's unacceptable. Everybody needs to come to the table. This is an incredibly serious issue. This is a time for leadership, and it certainly would have been helpful if President Trump was actually involved in the negotiations.
But is Congress nearing any sort of agreement that would step in then?
There's still an impasse. There needs to be a focus on getting it done. I know certainly as Democrats, we are willing to compromise and to find common ground, but you need to have both sides willing to do that.
Senator Gary Peters, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. Writer Donovan Hahn's preoccupations with water may sound familiar to anyone who lives near the Great Lakes. He thinks about coastlines as messy places where different kinds of people come together. He thinks about fresh water, the most essential substance on Earth, and how far out of reach it is for so many. Hahn teaches creative writing at Wayne State University and has written and edited for A-list publications like the New York Times, Harper's, and GQ. He has a way of drilling down on details in ways that open up much broader ideas. His latest collection of essays is called The Inner Coast. He spoke with April Baer in May. Here's their conversation.
You lead off the book with a long essay about a relative of yours, Tom, who collects tools. And you early on cop to the suspicion that tool collectors may be motivated by slightly odd feelings and that they're, you know, they're definitely an unusual bunch. But you grow fascinated through the essay by Tom's fascination with tools. And you note some of the fetishized aspects of tool history, the proliferation of tools and what it says about skilled labor in America during the first few hundred years. And there was this time when America's top tool was the wood plane, when woodcraft was sort of the dominant hand industry. And then you bring us along through the rise of the wrench and industrialization and mechanization. Could you read for us from a point in this, maybe set up the reading as well?
Yeah. So this is a passage that comes in response to a book by Eric Sloan, who was at the time a kind of a classic historian of antique woodworking tools. Here's the passage. Time, it seems, is an ironist. That spring, factory workers were being laid off in record numbers. Michigan alone had lost 171,000 manufacturing jobs in the previous 4 years, and the riveters and machine operators Eric Sloan derided seemed like skilled artisans compared with the technicians and sales associates replacing them. The era of the wrench, like the era of the plane before it, is ending. Predictably, the ranks of wrench collectors recently have begun to swell. Although still worth far less than a desirable plane, a rare and pristine John Deere tractor wrench can now fetch hundreds of dollars at auction. Partly, this reflects the enthusiasm in rural America for the antique tractors with which such wrenches were originally sold. But the popularity of other wrench varieties, pipe wrenches, automobile wrenches, buggy wrenches, battery cable pulling wrenches, is also growing. The decline of American manufacturing has given rise to pastoralism's post-industrial analog, A Romance of Rust.
That's Donovan Hone reading from an essay in The Inner Coast, his book just published. Donovan, what does that Romance of Rust tell you about who we are and where we are right now?
I think that part of what was fascinating to me when I was traveling with my Uncle Tom, who was a botanist, he was collecting these tools from estate auctions, from condemned factories, and he would taxonomize them, almost treat them like they were zoological specimens, which is a very different way of looking at these artifacts of America's material history than how many collectors look at them. For many collectors, I think that the act of collecting, there's a yearning for the kind of lost knowledge and lost time, an attempt to preserve it in the form of the objects. And they were amazingly beautiful, actually, many of these tools. And my uncle never wanted to restore them. He never wanted to touch them up with paint. He wanted to keep them in their actual state. So you could sometimes see places where a laborer's sweaty palm had left a mark in the oxidation of the metal. So I think that for me, that there's a way in which these tools came to kind of make visible to us something that's hard to see otherwise, which is the pace of technological change over the last century. That's, I think, what drew me into it. And how do we think about that change in ways that isn't nostalgic, that's clear-eyed, but also how do we reckon with the genuine loss, I think, of all that labor and all that knowledge that those tools held?
Your writing style has a fantastic kind of elastic quality to it. You're giving us these scenes from bouncing around to estate sales and other places with Tom, but also sort of taking us down the wormhole into Sloan's historical research into this, you know, warts and all. You don't really get caught up in an over-linear telling of your story, and you're great about just jetting what you're supposed to be talking about in favor of what you find really interesting. Has that been a hard thing to learn how to pull off as a writer?
When I was a graduate student in poetry, of all things, there was the poet Frank Bedard, actually, whom I quote in this particular essay, had this really nice, helpful thing, which he said that after you've learned how other minds make meaning, you have to learn how your mind makes meaning. And I have found that for me, that I always need to be doing both. For me, the essays I love as a reader, but also that I've tried to learn to write, will take us on journeys, tell stories, help us meet people who are fun to read about. But there's always a kind of an attempt to make sense of something that's accompanying that journey, that narrative. And that's just kind of how my brain works, I think.
This is a collection of essays that appeared in a lot of different publications over really many years. Can you tell us a little bit about the process of pulling them together and anything you noticed?
Well, at Wayne State University, where I teach writing now, I teach a course on the essay collection as theme and variation. So I almost think of it as if we're thinking about like a piece of music, a Bach fugue or whatever, where you kind of introduce a theme and then you try to complicate it and complicate it and complicate it. And I think there's a way in which I'm trying to do that, at least in this essay collection. One thing that's unusual for me, though, is I wrote them over many years. And I think the more one writes, the more one realizes that we can't quite ever escape our own preoccupations. You almost don't have to try the themes or ideas or geographies that you keep returning to. Kind of, they're a little bit mysterious in their origins, but they're there. So they emerged over the course of these. The first earliest essay in the book I wrote probably in the year 2000. So it's almost 20 years of these.
As you're talking about the essential qualities of water, you also point out the ways in which humanity or Western civilization has sort of stopped thinking about that. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, this is fascinating. There's a paradox to me, which is at a time when we have more information, more ways of understanding the world than we'll ever be able to explore in a lifetime. I mean, we could go onto Google Earth and look at every river and body of water on the planet now and from the safety of our desk. That coincides with a kind of distance or alienation from an actual kind of firsthand, intimate knowledge of I think, much of the natural world. So we can watch a BBC's Blue Planet and see things that are under the waves, but to actually experience it or study a river the way people did when they had to navigate them, that kind of knowledge, I think, has become increasingly abstract. It's even in our landscapes, I feel like, except for some picturesque waterfronts, that much of the water, many of the waterways of the interior have kind of receded from view. So there were, in a number of these essays, I'm trying to bring back the view from the water.
You've done some writing about the Flint water crisis.
Yeah.
And in this collection, we find your essay, The Zealot, which is about Mark Edwards, the Virginia Tech professor who became one of the leading critics of Flint in the water crisis. How did you meet him?
Well, so when I started talking to my editors at the Times Magazine about writing about him and the water crisis, frankly, Michigan Radio had done such wonderful reporting. The story was, this was early 2016 when finally the news was really getting out into the world. But Edwards was an interesting figure to me. What interested me most about his work was that, in my experience, having written about lots of different scientists, especially in my first book, that there's a real tension often in the sciences between kind of pure science there as a detached observer doing research and any kind of advocacy or activism. So that's the main reason I was curious about him, because he was somebody who was very vocal in his advocacy. Those were kind of, that tension was what I kind of wanted to think through and explore in that piece.
You trace a bit of his journey from, in his words, sort of a regular college professor to something of a lightning rod, calling out problems in Flint and, as you say, taking more of an advocacy stance. But what a lot of people may not have known about him, at least outside of Flint, is that Edwards is also a conservative Republican who's much more concerned about misconduct in public institutions than in private ones. What did you learn about how he is seen within the field as you were working on this?
Well, in some ways that made him even more interesting, because it certainly, I think, went against my assumptions going in, that he has this a kind of libertarian streak in his politics. And, you know, I wanted to spend time with him in order to understand how to reconcile both. I mean, I think he's got a very sincere concern about environmental justice, and he'll say that, you know, he got into his field because of concern about what had happened to the Great Lakes when he was growing up, and he'd witnessed Lake Erie get kind of saved by the Clean Water Act. And so those things can be reconciled. But I think the other thing that was fascinating to me was watching how much of a deft storyteller he was. And I felt that in some ways that the storytelling could maybe be complicated. When I visited him, a book on his floor in the place where he lives in Virginia, it was a book kind of has a horrible title. It was called Houston, We Need a Narrative. And it was by a scientist turned screenwriter, kind of telling people how to use the methods of Hollywood storytelling to help communicate science to the public. And I think that in some ways, the more I spent time with him, I think that I felt that the storytelling tended to be a little bit scripted in that kind of classic villains and victims kind of way.
Right.
So that's what I was trying to make sense of.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Donovan Hone. His new book is a collection of essays from the past decade or so. It's called The Inner Coast. You write at some length in one of the essays in the book, Falling, about your childhood, growing up outside of San Francisco on Mount Davidson. Could you tell us a little bit about your parents?
Yeah, I could. Well, you know, my father grew up in a town called Philo, Illinois, which almost sounds like a ridiculously idyllic name for a small town on the plains of Illinois. But really, in his side of the family, there was a devotion to the public university. My grandmother was the first in her family to go to college, and it was on a scholarship to the University of Illinois. And he decided in the 60s to do a medical career and ended up in academic medicine, which carried him to California eventually for a residency in San Francisco. My mother's family was very itinerant. She was an Air Force brat. My grandfather was a colonel. But after his military career, he too ended up in central Illinois, which is where she met my father. And she, even before he went out to California, had had a real, in her youth, a real kind of wanderlust and energy that I think made her restless. And she actually bicycled across the Western United States from Milwaukee to Northern California.
At a time when that was not done, especially by single women.
No, yeah, it was 1963 that she did it. She was a young 20-something. She had a buddy for the first part of it, but from the Rocky Mountains to the coast, she was solo. No, it was gutsy and impressive. And that's how she ended up out in on the coast of California. She'd had a dream that she was going to hop a steamship across the Pacific to reunite with a boy she'd met at a Red Cross training camp in Japan. It was a Korean boy she'd met. And she had been dreaming of reuniting with them, and that journey was interrupted, and I am the result of the interruption.
Your parents had a very difficult marriage.
They did.
And your mother actually ran away for a while when you and your brother were small kids. There are some really heartbreaking passages in this essay about her time away. Do you mind reading a little bit?
No, I don't. I'll just say she was, you know, this was part of the project for me in this essay was trying to understand her departures. And the easy way to understand them might be to say that she was clinically depressive, which I believe she was. But for her, it was much more than that. She had experienced a kind of crisis of faith after a very religious upbringing. And I wanted to write as empathetically about her experience and my own, which was difficult. So here's a passage. The year before we moved to the mountain, when I was almost 3 and my brother was 5, our mother had run away. For 9 months, or was it 8 or 6, testimonies conflict as they always do, memories fail as they always do. The record, as always, is unclear. She'd lived by herself in a boarding hotel near the train yards of South San Francisco. The first night she was gone, I woke up terrified that something horrible had befallen us. Above me, the mattress of my brother's bunk had begun to shed its gauzy underside, which hung down in strings that I liked to pluck at, making them longer. Atop the dresser, our fish tank gurgled and glowed. A year later, on the morning we moved to Mount Davidson, I would try to carry it, still full of water, out to the truck and succeed only in dunking the lid far enough for the bulb inside to electrify the tank's lonely resident, a zebrafish, which on the night my mother left drifted obliviously through plastic kelp, a rebuke to the hysteria that had awakened me. Uncharacteristically brave in the darkness, I conducted a thorough investigation of the premises. In the bedroom where my mother usually could be found, my giant father, snoring and alone, sprawled diagonally atop the tangled sheets as if dropped there from a great height. I looked in closets, under furniture, even inside the dishwasher, from which I distinctly remember steam rose trying to do.
What do you tell your students about taking on uncomfortable subjects?
Oh, lots of things. And it kind of depends on the subject, and it kind of depends on their relationship to the subject. If we're thinking about writing about painfully personal material, I think it's not uncommon that sometimes as writers we need a certain amount of distance. Really, I think this was able to write this essay, began working on it, I think, when I was around 30, and it took a while. So there was a distance from it. I think that when one is writing, in some ways I feel very much that this essay, more than any others in the book, is mine to tell. Certainly it contains many of my earliest memories and experiences. But we never are just telling our own stories. That's, I think, one of the challenges. Our stories are always entangled with the world around us, whether it's with the lives of family members or neighbors or a polity. And so it takes a great deal of care in how one handles the stories, one's own stories, but also those of others. I think when writing about family members or loved ones, for me, there are two great dangers. One is that we might sentimentalize loved ones. And I do think that that can be a kind of a form of dehumanizing them, simplifying them. And then, of course, I think sometimes in memoirs, there's a risk of we don't want to vilify. You'll lose the trust of the readers if it feels like we're settling some sort of score. So it takes it's a strange combination of great emotional empathy, but also a certain amount of detachment from one's own emotions, I think, to do it with the needed delicacy.
That's pretty Herculean, considering the subject matter that you're working with here. Donovan Hone's latest collection of essays is The Inner Coast, and it's available right now from Norton Books. It's the kind of read that really works if you're looking for something to disappear into right now. Donovan, thanks very much for talking with us.
April, thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. We've heard from a lot of teachers that they're worried about the kids whose families are dealing with serious issues at home right now. Some children have parents who are out of a job. Some were homeless before the pandemic, and others are just tipping over the brink. Michigan has the sixth highest population of homeless students in the country, and many of those children depend on the consistency of in-person teaching. Jennifer Erb Downward studies homelessness at the Center for Poverty Solutions at the University of Michigan. She spoke with April recently, and the conversation began with an acknowledgement of the many faces of homelessness, from families experiencing a single incident to those in and out of shelters for years.
What does student homelessness look like in the state of Michigan? Do you tend to think about it in terms of periodic episodes for kids whose families are on the low end of the economic ladder, or more in terms of chronic conditions that may last all the way through some kids' academic careers?
You know, I think that we see both, really. But I feel like where we really need to start with this conversation is thinking about how widely spread homelessness is and widely experienced homelessness is for children in the state of Michigan. So while there's a lot of agreement that the economic impact that COVID-19 has had on the state, that we'll see an increase in the number of people experiencing homelessness, what I think not many people know about is the fact that one out of every 12 students among Michigan's fifth graders experienced homelessness at some point during elementary school. So we really have a lot of children in the state of Michigan who are living on this edge, and some of them are experiencing homelessness over multiple years. Some of them are experiencing homelessness episodically. For some students, it's a one-time experience, but really one out of every 12 students on average in the state of Michigan are experiencing homelessness at some point during elementary school. And that's really a lot of students.
If there were no COVID this year, what would we be talking about with respect to the accommodations that students who are living with housing insecurity, that what accommodations they need in their school days?
The first thing is, when we think about accommodations for homeless students, what do you think we really want to be thinking about is rights that homeless students have. Because fundamentally, homeless students have a right to the same education that their peers have. And the idea behind McKinney-Vento law is that you don't want to see housing instability and homelessness taking away that fundamental right of an education for children.
Can you explain the law for the layperson?
Sure. So the law basically defines homelessness for children as any student who is lacking a fixed, regular, adequate nighttime residence. So they really don't have a stable place where they're living. And so some things that the law has done to provide supports and to help students have access to the education that they have a right to is, one, a right to immediate enrollment in school. So any parent who has ever enrolled their child in school knows that, you know, you show up, you have to provide certain documents, a proof of address, birth certificate, vaccination records. So one thing for families who are experiencing homelessness is that there will be a right to immediate enrollment. So they show up, their child is immediately enrolled, and then they have a period of time to gather those documents. Another right that's really critical is a right to transportation. So often when you're experiencing housing instability, you might end up living in a location that is far away from your child's original school. And so a child has a right to stay in that school and then also be provided with transportation support. And then on top of those rights, children also have the same right to access in terms of participation after school programs, you know, assistance with basic needs like school supplies, backpacks, you know, participation in maybe school field trips or access to a yearbook, things along those lines. So those are really the key elements that are part of the law.
Schools are dealing with a lot right now. Are they able to provide these kinds of accommodations in this moment?
So I think that's a great question. Federally, they are mandated to provide these accommodations, to provide these supports. One thing I think we're really thinking about, though, is if schools go remote, how do we identify students who are experiencing housing instability and homelessness? And that's a really critical piece. Another element that we need to think about here is just some of the very basic needs. Schools are where many children receive their meals, sometimes breakfast, lunch, and even dinner. And if schools are not open, how are we getting those supplies? How are we getting those resources to kids? You know, another example I think can be is as we think about remote learning, because many schools are looking into this.
Well, I did want to ask you about that, actually. We've talked to an awful lot of educators who are increasingly feeling like, even if their district has not come out and said it already, that a significant portion of the year is going to be conducted online. What accommodations can schools make for homeless students if a district is only doing online teaching?
Well, the first thing is that they need to figure out how to provide that student with the resources they need to participate in online learning. So a laptop, access to Wi-Fi. And one element to that, Detroit Public Schools is actually participating with the Detroit City on a very interesting effort to reduce the digital divide and promote digital equity. What they've done as a part of this is that they've tied the Wi-Fi to the laptop. You know, if you're thinking about how do you address the digital divide for many people, often you might tie that to a house. But I think when we're talking about homelessness and housing instability and thinking about what the needs are of children who are highly mobile, we need to be making sure that if we're talking about remote learning, if we're talking about providing Wi-Fi and laptops, that that Wi-Fi is something that moves with the laptop, that moves with the child.
Jennifer, no doubt there are a million ways in which students and families find ways to cover when they're in between apartments, when they're crashing with relatives or sleeping in their car. Can we assume that COVID makes it more difficult to keep people from knowing what's going on with them?
I mean, I think there are a number of different ways that I think it's going to make it more difficult for people to know what's going on with them. You know, if we're looking at the remote environment, there is not necessarily going to be in-person enrollment that where you would have that opportunity to talk to a family and identify that they might be struggling. For many families, one of the reasons why childhood homelessness and family homelessness is so invisible in terms of when we think about what homelessness looks like societally is because so many families will just double up with another family temporarily or couch surf or live in their car. One thing that the pandemic will really impact in that way, not as many people are going to feel comfortable taking someone in. For families that do end up staying with other families, they're then living in an overcrowded situation, and both families are going to be at greater risk in terms of COVID. So there are real issues of overcrowding, the impact that that might have on people's health. If someone gets sick, will they be able to stay there? Will they get kicked out? Where will they be able to recover? So there's just so many different issues that are wrapped up, I think, in what's going on now. And all of the challenges that we see people struggling with, they're just magnified when we think about not having the stability of a place that you live, that you know you can be, that you know you can recover, where you know your child will be safe.
Do you worry about the students who may be living on the street and just spending, having that same worry that so many parents have about their kids now, that they're just spending more time unsupervised?
So for children who are unaccompanied and homeless youth, this is a group that really is at the greatest risk. And I think that is actually acutely true for Michigan. because of a number of laws that the state has. And I'm just going to mention those really quickly, and then I'll, you know, go back to some of the risks that these youth face. But in the state of Michigan, minors are not allowed to consent for their own health care. So if you have an unaccompanied minor who's experiencing homelessness on the street, maybe they're couch surfing, if they get sick, they don't have the ability to go and seek medical care and consent for medical care on their own. This means that they would have to be in a state of life-threatening emergency for them to be receiving care. That is exactly what we don't want to see in the context of a pandemic. We also see that access to shelter for youth who are minors and unaccompanied is really limited, because there is a licensing law in the state of Michigan that requires that there's parental consent within 24 hours of an unaccompanied minor seeking shelter. And, you know, because for minors, when they are running away from home, this is most often a crisis of relationship, right? So you need time to establish safety. You need time to establish what is the story of what's happened. How can you best help that child? And 24 hours is not sufficient. With these regulations or policies that have existed prior to COVID, again, what is missing now is that youth also don't have access to schools. They don't have access to drop-in centers, to libraries, all of the places where there may have been adults that were helping in some way to provide a point of connection, to provide support and resources. They are missing right now. But we need to figure out, how can we reach youth who don't have adults who are able to support them, who don't have access to any of these services right now? And then just really thinking about how our current laws that existed before the pandemic are even more adversely affecting these youth now. It's placing them at greater risk for human trafficking. We know that mental health, depression, suicidality among unaccompanied youth and homeless youth, it's higher than the general population of youth overall. This is going to again be exacerbated in the current crisis, particularly when people don't have networks of support, or these networks of support have been broken.
Within the past few days, the governor's moratorium on evictions came to an end. And I was wondering how you see that affecting the school year and all of these needs for all these kids.
Yeah, so that is, you know, that is a really big issue. I think all of us are waiting to see what happens moving forward with bills passed around unemployment insurance, to see whether that continues. There are a lot of families who are at risk of facing eviction. One thing I think that it's important for everyone to know about from a prevention standpoint is that the state of Michigan's allocated $50 million to rental assistance through their eviction prevention program. And so anyone or any family who has received a notice to quit from their landlord or a summons from the court, and if they have less income than the area median income, they're eligible for these funds. So one thing that I would strongly advocate is for, you know, all school districts, as they are working to enroll students, whether they're going remotely or in person, that this information is shared with families, because there are going to be so many more families who are at risk of losing their home. And the educational consequences, the health consequences of not having a stable place to live for a child are huge.
You mentioned that the state is making some cash assistance available for housing costs. Are there other resources available for the families that are in an insecure position right now?
The other resource that I think it would be incredibly helpful, again, for schools, social service agencies, any group that is in connection with families, particularly as schools are starting to roll out their plan, is the federal stimulus. There are a lot of families who are eligible for this who have not yet received federal stimulus. And many of those families are going to be the families who are at most risk. So families who earn less than $24,000 a year are not required to file taxes. This means that if they've never filed taxes, they will not automatically be getting that benefit.
Or it may be they don't have a bank account and no place to report in to get the deposit sent.
That is another very large issue, but there are ways around that. So if a family doesn't have a bank account, a community organization can work with them. You can link an EBT card to that. There are actually a number of resources that are highlighted on Poverty Solutions' website. that provide instructions for all the different ways that you can go about trying to apply for the stimulus, to access stimulus, what to do if you don't have a bank account. But the fact of the matter is that a lot of families who are experiencing housing instability right now likely have not received that benefit. And that is money that could be a huge help, particularly in the context of the pandemic right now and the instability that people are experiencing. So again, spreading that information widely with families is really important right now. And I think there's an opportunity to do that in the context of enrollment. How do we make sure that as we are rolling out school, which I know is incredibly complicated right now, but we need to be thinking about how we meet the basic needs of families as well.
If a family is dealing with housing insecurity, you know, where does COVID fall in terms of, you know, the worries that they have to deal with on a 24/7 basis? I imagine that it might seem like a different priority compared to where is my family going to sleep tonight?
I definitely think the number one priority for people is always going to be, where am I going to sleep tonight? You know, where am I going to get food? Then from there, I think it's probably going to depend on their experience. I mean, if you look at people who know other families, other people who have died of COVID, I'm sure are much more frightened, are taking that much more seriously, are prioritizing it because it does seem like a life and death situation. I think there's always a hierarchy of needs. You deal with first what you have to deal with, right? And shelter and food are always going to be sort of the top among that. But I still think that there's going to be a wide range of how people are thinking about prevention, or whether or not they feel like they have the option to think about prevention. And I think that might depend a lot on where they are and what they're seeing around them and what the social norms around them are, how many people they've seen impacted. I mean, at first people said, you know, coronavirus was going to be the great equalizer, right? But what we see is it's far from being an equalizer. We see huge disparities among races and economics, and I think that will impact also how people respond to prevention. What is their experience? What have they seen around them? You know, I spoke with a woman not so long ago in Detroit who told me that she knew, you know, 5 different people who had died. You know, that I think places you in a very different mindset than if you don't know anyone. I think it's going to be mixed.
Jennifer Erb Downward is a senior research associate at the University of Michigan Center for Poverty Solutions. Jennifer, thanks for talking us through some of this.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
That's it for today's show. Stateside is produced by Mike Blank and April Van Buren, with help from our interns Leah Baldori, Catherine Newhan, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Our director is Mercedes Mejia. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Laura Weber Davis. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you tomorrow.